Let the record show that the House Education Committee is convened at 9:03 a.m. on February 1st. The following House members are present: Representative Seaton, Representative Ledoux, Representative Drummond, Representative Peggy Wilson. Representative Gaddis is excused for a meeting with the governor, and myself, the vice chair, will be chairing today, Representative Reinbold. Before we start, please let's turn off any cell phones or electronic devices that may interfere with the meeting. And while we're talking, we're also just welcoming Representative Sadler. Welcome, Representative Sadler. Today we will be listening to a presentation by the Alaska Department of Education and Early Development on their organizational structures and their duties. And we are welcoming Commissioner Hanley. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Reinbold. For the record, my name is Mike Hanley. I'm the Commissioner for the Department of Education and Early Development. And as this is our first meeting, I would like to just recognize a couple of my staff that are here today. I have our legislative liaison, who will oftentimes do work with you, and that's Marcy Herman is here. Paul Pressing is our Deputy Director of Teaching and Learning Support, which is our largest division, which we'll talk about. He may come up shortly. I'd also like to recognize Chris Simon in the back. And Chris Simon is our Rural Education Coordinator, former superintendent, principal, and has worked all around the state and been done tremendous work for us all around the state, especially in rural Alaska. So I've been asked today by Representative Gaddis to provide an overview of the department's structure. It's not the financial aspects, but it's just how we are laid out, how we operate, and also kind of the bounds of our authority, if you will. What do we have responsibility for, and what don't we have responsibility for? So I'll go over that at a high level, and Chair Reinbold, as you see fit, we can allow questions throughout the presentation or at the end.
Would you prefer more of an informal, or would you prefer to wait?
The informal works fine for me.
Okay, great.
Let me get this up to our... the state and the department, our responsibilities are defined by our Constitution, the Alaska Constitution, where it states that the legislature shall by general law establish and maintain a system of public schools open to all children of the state. It has been further defined that establish and maintain means to adequately fund education, to provide oversight and support for our schools, to set content standards of what we want our children to learn, and to set put in place assessments to measure students on their progress towards those standards. Education policy. Our education policy is defined in statute as well, and the purpose of education, it states, is to help ensure that all children, all students, will succeed in education and their work. The important point here, and I see we're not projecting, I'm assuming you have it or don't, do you have it? Do you have this presentation?
We have it. We have it in our books.
Okay. So I just wasn't sure if you were able to follow, see what I'm seeing.
Well, usually. Yeah. The committee aid.
Let me turn on the projector. I can't tell if I referenced a chart and everybody. As that's becoming clearer, what is worth noting is that the responsibilities at the state level, the department and the state in general, does not go down into local decision making at the local school board level. Personnel decisions at the local level, curricular decisions, personnel decisions, those are all made at the local level. So here's just a simple slide that references on the left-hand side the state responsibilities and duties. And it goes back to what I mentioned previously, the financing, the standards and assessments, and school accountability designations for student performance, for properly spending the funds that are appropriated to them. The local responsibilities, on the other hand, they manage their own budgets. They audit all their own school accounts. They provide the educational programs as determined, and that could be a traditional model, that could be a correspondence model, and that could be a charter school, it could be ABC model. Those decisions are all made at the local level, as well as how classrooms are operated and those local decisions. Also, the review and selection of all textbooks and instructional materials is done at the local level, as especially I know Representative Drummond knows well, as the math curriculum has gotten, and Representative Reinbold too, that math, the recent adoption of a new math program there has been a big conversation in Anchorage.
Good choice.
Yeah.
Madam Chair. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. If a teacher doesn't have textbooks or something, she doesn't come to you and complain. She needs to go to the superintendent or whoever.
Right. The local structure would typically be principal, superintendent, school board. That's exactly right.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Some of the initiatives that we do were statewide, such as the District 5 iPad, and that was funded from the state. Does the state have the responsibility then for us getting back to us on what the assessment was and how that worked or didn't work, or do we need to go to the local school districts as that is not only textbook, but it's also instructional materials?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it depends on how the legislature determines how that funding goes. For the iPads, that was a direct appropriation, so although it went through the Alaska Association of School Boards, I know they have the data. I have access, I can ask them for their data, but we don't carry that data. We don't monitor that particular program because of the way it was funded. Some do, some don't. The theme-based education is another one that went to the Iditarod School District. I have asked the superintendent who is running that for data, but we're not in that loop per se. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, just as a follow-up to his question, can we make a formal request to you, or would you prefer us go ahead and formally, or is there someone here that can do that for us?
We
really are very interested in the iPads and what kind of outcomes did it achieve what we needed it to. Before we invest any more money in that, we want to make sure that it did what you all wanted it to achieve.
Right.
So we would like a report of how that worked.
Right.
It was District 5 or District 6. It was whatever Representative Dix.
Best would be we could do it, or someone on staff could just request that from AASB.
Would you mind doing that?
The Alaska Association of School Boards.
Okay, I'll request Jim Ellis to do that.
Okay, and I believe I saw Bob Wicker in the back, who's with the school board.
Okay.
There he is in the back.
Oh,
so
fantastic.
He heard that
Thank
as
you.
Well. So.
Okay. Representative Ledoux.
I may have missed something here. What are you talking about with the iPads with Representative?
Okay, it's my understanding that there was a distribution of iPads to Representative Alan Dix's district, and they were hoping to achieve certain outcomes. If you can clarify, that'd be terrific.
Yes. Thank you, through the chair. Representative Ledoux, a significant portion of some funding was allocated or appropriated for a one-to-one initiative. So iPads were introduced into classrooms, one iPad per student. And not only was it wasn't just to match technology with a student, but to change the way teachers did things and to change the way they taught. So some professional development went along with this. And so the teachers, for a year, changed the way they taught using this new tool. And it was in a primary grades. It'll be in the data on just what grades, but it was in elementary school. And there's a big focus on reading. And so we saw significant changes and positive changes in reading proficiencies and reading scores. Significant growth. So the goal was to change the way teachers taught using these tools. And so now the School Boards Association has that data.
So can I follow up on this? So this was a pilot program in a specific school district?
Yes, it was. I don't know if the term pilot, but it was a one-time project. I will say that what we see now in the governor's proposal, the digital, the one-to-one initiative on a larger scale, recognizes the impact that that project had on student learning and looking to implement that on a larger scale.
Thank you.
Please continue.
The overall structure of our Department of Education is slightly different than other departments in the state. Oftentimes, the commissioner is the head of the department. I act more as a CEO, if you will, would be a better analogy. The State Board of Education and Early Development is the head of our department. And then myself, and then within our department, we have five key divisions, teaching and learning support, school finance and facilities, and some of you heard teaching and learning support is headed up by our new Susan McCauley and Paul Pressing is here today. School finance and facilities, some of you have heard from Elizabeth Noodleman. Our administrative services, Mark Lewis does that work, who just testified earlier today. Our libraries, archives, and museums, and the Mount Edison Boarding School. It is the only, it's kind of a unique school. It's the only state-run school that we have. And that's run by the state. The three bottom ones are called active partnerships. You see that there aren't direct lines connected to them, but they're operated by their own commissions or boards. We provide administrative services for those three. So they are within our budget. They are within our department, but we don't directly control their work.
Commissioner Hanley, what's the criteria for getting into Mount Edgecombe? How do they decide who gets to go there and who doesn't get to go there?
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, they have an enrollment process and an application process that they go through. It's a part of their handbook. It's a part of their policy. So it looks at the potential for success. It looks at parental support. It looks for, you know, so I could provide you with an application process that they have. It's a public document, but they haven't. Like charter schools and like our other boarding schools in the state, they have an application process.
Just to follow up, is there native preference for Mount Edgecombe, or is it strictly where you're living? The further out you are, the more likely you are to get into the place.
Through the chair, there's not a native preference, although we do see a high percentage of natives at the school. The best way would just be to get you that application process. I don't believe there's even an aspect of where you live that is a component of that. But it's been a while since I've looked at their application process.
I'd like to see that if I could.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. And just as a follow-up to that, I believe Representative Gaddis is going to have an overview on Mount Edgecombe in the near future. So I'd like to get to Representative Harriet Drummond.
Actually, that's what I was going to – thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to remind the group that I asked for a presentation on Mount Edgecombe in the budget subcommittee that met just previous to this one. It would be great to kind of roll up all that in together.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Great. The bottom three, the Professional Teaching Practices Commission, it basically deals with complaints against teachers and administrators, school employees who violate professional standards. Alaska State Council of the Arts is there, as well as our Commission on Post-Secondary Education. That is headed up by Diane Behrens, and the Alaska Performance Scholarship is a function, is implemented by the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. As I just go down to just kind of break down each of those components, as we look at our structure, our teaching and learning support is our largest. There are 93 staff members there, and it's broken down into several divisions. We have, on the left-hand side, you'll see the early learning, Head Start. We have state money that leverages a significant amount of federal money for Head Start. Our Alaska Pre-K program, there has been money. We've got currently 8 school districts operating pre-K programs based on a competitive grant process. With our pre-K program. Best Beginnings have been funded by the legislature. It's part of the Imagination Library, providing books for students at an early age. They get support. They set up support in local communities, and then they distribute books on a monthly basis to children with supporting activities for parents to engage their kids in reading and just family engagement types of things. That's not operated, that's in our budget, but we don't operate that program. No. And Parents as Teachers is another early learning program.
Okay. Okay. If you can hold on just for a moment. Representative Wilson.
Could you give us an idea with the early learning, like how many schools or how many Head Starts there are in the state? And then you said that there were 8 schools with that had pre-K. And then how many have Head Start collaboration and how many use Best Beginnings and how many use Parents as Teachers?
Several of these. I've got a sheet that's got, I couldn't tell you right now off the top of my head how many Head Starts there are around the state because Head Start is not, we don't support necessarily all of them. But there are several of the, about half of them, I believe, have components of the 8 that are tied to Head Start programs. And I'm looking through, let's see. The Anchorage School District works with Head Start. Bering Strait School District works with Head Start. And I'd have to look deeper, but those are the ones that come out right now.
Yeah.
Paul, do you know any? Okay.
Because follow up.
Okay, Representative Wilson.
Because I know Wrangell does. You know, we have a Head Start on the school property, so I don't know. I was just curious to know how many of the schools across the state use these programs.
Right. I was referring just to the 8. I don't believe Wrangell is one of the 8 pre-K programs, is it?
No.
So yeah. So my list was the 8 pre-K who have combined with Head Start services. So you're right. Head Start is in a lot of schools.
Representative Ledoux.
I'm just wondering with some of these programs, like Head Start's been around for a long time. I'm not sure about Best Beginnings. But have there been any empirical studies done either through the state of Alaska or some of these programs like Head Start, that's a national program, to see the outcomes of the kids who've attended these programs as compared to the kids who haven't attended these programs, to see whether, in fact, they're working as they're intended to be working?
Through the chair, Head Start has done those. We don't do those separately, but Head Start has. We monitor those that are within our pre-K program. And there have been supports, and we have seen results that that have come from those. Last year, Senator French put on a summit, an early education summit with Head Start, and they had data. They shared data that there was a correlation between Head Start and staying out of jail, and it was an interesting correlation. But that's one that they used at their summit. So there is data that Head Start has. What we have done at the department. With the funds that we have provided as a state, Head Start provides wraparound services. They provide a lot of the social components, the physical components, the family services, which are tremendous, especially in Alaska for students. What we've also worked with them on is to engage them in the academic components of that. And so when we see them, especially in our pre-K programs, we use Teaching Strategies Gold, which is a strategy that uses those other tools, the wraparound services, but also helps them prepare through particular strategies, prepare for kindergarten and for school.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brief question, Mr. Commissioner. With Head Start and Best Beginnings, et cetera, what's the youngest age at which a student will become involved in the public education system?
Our public aside from these 8 pre-K programs, which would go down to, I believe it's 4 years old, other than that, the only other early education that we have, that we run as a state, you know, begins at kindergarten. So Best Beginnings starts at birth. But that's a program that the funding goes through us to Best Beginnings, but we don't, and Parents as Teachers does that well. Great services, but we don't consider them part of the public education process. They're grants to programs that provide early learning services.
So generally 4 years old.
Yes.
But
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My experience with the Anchorage School District is that if students are identified with special needs, they can start in the public schools as early as age 3 with special needs and special education.
To the chair, that's correct. It's part of our Child Find program, and actually one of the schools that I was the principal of in Anchorage, at Cassoon, we had 3 early intervention programs that were our pre-K programs. So
thank you
for.
And also, Madam Chair, if I might,
please.
I'm aware of the Head Start longitudinal studies, which were made many years ago, and I'm sure they continue to be done, that a dollar spent in Head Start saves us as a society $7 later. And Head Start students end up in solid marriages, going to college, holding down jobs, and, as the Commissioner said, staying out of jail.
And I'm actually going to take liberty to ask a question as well. One of my education advisors has questioned the outcomes of Head Start, and I, with all due respect, I'd love to see that data. But there's a lot of programs out there. The cost of education is dramatically increasing. We're 50th in the nation with our NEP scores. In fourth grade reading, we're not doing everything right, obviously. We're doing many good things, and I understand that. But we are trying to make wise decisions and getting the best buck for our dollar investment. And as we were at the mansion yesterday with Dr. Elliott, with the First Lady, it's critical. Early intervention is absolutely critical. But with the results that we're seeing right now, we're having a hard time deciding where to invest, you know, the dollars right now. So if you could please somehow give this committee an overview of these programs. Are they truly value-added? Where's the best bang for the buck? Where are the issues, and where are we seeing success? We need to know that to make investment, Commissioner.
I can do the Alaska Pre-K. That's the component that we own, if you will, and we do have great, very strong data for that. This will be our fourth year of running that, and the rest we could get from Head Start, Best Beginnings, and Parents as Teachers too. And we do have a staff member. Since the funding was increased for parents as teachers, so we could provide some of the data for you for parents as teachers.
Thank you. I think that would answer a lot of our questions up here. We appreciate that. Please continue.
Looking at the statewide, I will mention that Elizabeth Nudelman is also here. She stepped up to get my back there for a moment. So, and if it's okay with you, Chair Reinbold, that as we need staff, I've let them know to feel free to come up and just to make sure that your questions are answered and we get what you need.
Absolutely, they're welcomed.
Great. Moving to the statewide mentoring program. It's a program that has shown positive results in teacher retention, which we know is an issue in Alaska, as well as student achievement. So students who are in a classroom with a brand new teacher tend to perform not as well as a seasoned teacher, and yet when we incorporate the use of a mentor with a new teacher, they perform comparably to their peers with a seasoned teacher. So we've seen student data be improved, as well as teacher retention improved. So we have mentors for new teachers around the state. Our administrative coaching process program takes the teacher component and actually works directly with leadership. It works with principals and with superintendents. You would think that once they've been around long enough, they wouldn't need it, but it is a whole different role on how to be a leader and how to empower teachers. So we have found both of those programs to be very effective. Student and school achievement. Several components of that are assessment and accountability is a part of that. Those are the assessments that we do statewide. That includes the SBAs that we do annually, our standards-based assessment, the Terra Nova, our work keys. All of those things fall into our assessment and accountability. Our charter schools and correspondence schools are also in there. The Alaska Learning Network is currently in there and is also one of the governor's, in the governor's budget to provide for funding to continue that program. That's a distance learning network. The idea is to provide high quality, vetted courses provided by Alaskan highly qualified teachers focused on the Alaska standards to kids across the state, especially when you have small schools that may not have many teachers in their school, they can access some of these tools through the Alaska Learning Network. Health and safety, we have several components in there. The governor has been very focused on domestic violence and sexual assault. We have components in the Department of Education to support that initiative, the Choose Respect campaign. We have the fourth R, is the fourth R curriculum, the fourth R being healthy relationships. We also have Coaching Boys in the Gym, which is to work with athletic coaches to do more than coach athletics, but to help train men to grow up to be respectful individuals and contributing members outside, off the court, as well as on. We work hand in hand on those programs. We only have a small component of the funding in our budget, but we work with Health and Social Services. We work with the DVSA Council. We also have several federal grant programs that are part of our department. Those are special education, Title I, student nutrition, those things. A small component of our department is teacher certification, and that's just the renewal of certifications, making sure the teachers have met the qualifications that they need, and new certifications. And then our Professional Teaching Practices Commission falls under that as well. And that's based out of Anchorage.
I'm sure.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Mr. Commissioner, our third bar under federal grant programs has a number of other bullets under it. It has special education, career and technical education, and no child left behind. Could you elaborate a little bit on your department's oversight of those programs?
We have funding that comes in for those programs and accountability measures that come in for those programs. So what I chose to do is take those off of this slide. I apologize. And they're surely appropriate that it's on your slide. The list is extensive.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, with No Child Left Behind, we have things that we need to follow up on in regards to our funding and how we measure our schools. The SBAs, our standards-based assessments, are a component of No Child Left Behind requirements. It's an extensive part of what we do. We have several employees that just work on the federal component side.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and on the special education piece, that's a major portion of funding that goes
yes.
to the schools. Do you get a piece of funding for special education and then assess how our schools are doing based on that?
Great. I'll call Paul up for the specifics on the special education component.
For the record, my name is Paul Preston. I'm the Deputy Director of Teaching and Learning Support. This is probably the second time I've had a speak in front of the chair of committee, so I'm a little nervous that I am. So in response to your question, we do get a little bit of state administrative money for our special education, mm-hmm. and it's a team right now of, we have three education specialists. They review all the grants for districts. We have an education special education administrator that kind of oversees the program. And just recently, they just completed the federal annual performance report, and so they review grants, review budgets, do monitoring, on-site monitoring, and collect the data that the federal government requires. And that's pretty much what the special education team does.
Mm, okay. Thank you.
Please continue.
Just hang there for a second. Yeah. And I will mention, it may be timely to mention in regards to No Child Left Behind, that that bar has moved up to where every district, every state, every child needs to be proficient by next year. And as we look at Congress's moves towards reauthorizing that to change the structure of that, we don't see things happening very fast. I would say we're still at least a couple of years out before that will change. And so Secretary Duncan for the U.S. Department of Education has offered waivers to states, and we hope at the end of our process of receiving a waiver from some of those components of No Child Left Behind. What we're looking at is changing accountability, something that is more appropriate rather than using the tools that say everybody's failing. So we're in the process of that. We anticipate, we sure hope that within the next few months we'll be looking at a waiver for Alaska.
Representative Wilson. Thank you, Madam Chair. How many, I know with No Child Left Behind, there's lots of rules and regulations and everything, and how many people does it take to administer that program?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we have, I have to look at my little org chart here just to make sure, but we have several teams within the department, and the No Child Left Behind team is comprised of approximately 11 people.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Please continue.
Moving over to our statewide system of support, we have, and I don't know, some of these slides might be different too, as we made modifications at the last minute, but the education content specialists, we have three content specialists actually in our department for literacy, for math, and for science, and they provide resources to districts as they need support. We can provide training, professional development, just access to other resources. So they're in our department. Then we also have school improvement coaches, and those coaches are working directly with our three intervention districts. So we have 10 school improvement coaches helping to build capacity at the local level for districts where the students have been chronically underperforming. And the last component is the child nutrition component, federally funded component. And it involves our school lunch program, the emergency food assistance program, and the child and adult food program.
Representative Ledoux?
Do you know how many children in our state are involved in the one of the subsidized breakfast programs or lunch programs?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, I don't know the number right off the top of my head because there's some of the programs are, you know, specifically just breakfast, some are lunch, and so there's quite an array of programs within there, but I can tell you that we have approximately 300 Title I schools, which are based on poverty, so, but I'd be remiss if I gave you a number off the top of my head because I don't know.
Can you get us that number? Because I've heard a percentage and I don't want to say it because I'm not sure that it's accurate.
Just to be clear, just the number of kids that are eligible for free and reduced lunch, is that or involved with a child nutrition meal program?
Involved with a subsidized child nutrition meal program based upon income. And can I follow up on that?
Sure.
So is the threshold for qualifying for that, is that the federal poverty line, or is that something in addition to the federal poverty line?
It's through the chair. It's in the census. It's in federal regs. It's the poverty line that's defined at the U.S. Department level.
Okay. And I'm gonna. Oh, do you need a follow up?
Yeah. So nobody gets it unless they are within that or below that poverty threshold. Is that correct?
Through
or
the chair,
if you're in a Title I school, does everybody get it?
Through the chair, you have to have a poverty threshold. Most districts, schools fill out an income questionnaire, and then their students are eligible for a free reduced lunch. Anyone can buy the lunch, but some kids, their lunches are subsidized, and it's income-based.
Thank you.
Okay, and would this number come from your Department of Public Assistance? Yesterday I met with the Department of Public Assistance, and I was alarmed to find out that we have 190,000 Alaskans on some sort of public assistance, and one of them was this, you know, food program. And it, so would this information come from you or from them?
Through the chair, Representative Reinbold, I don't know exactly where that information comes from, to be honest. I know we, for Title I programs, we get a combination of Health and Social Services data and U.S. Census data. Mm-hmm. The Child Nutrition program, I hate to speculate, but I'm 100%, I'm pretty sure that that comes from a combination also of Health and Social Service data and the U.S. Census data. I can find out exactly what
that is. That'd be terrific, because at our last subcommittee meeting, we talked about you guys actually were getting over 300,000 or 300 million, excuse me. I'm still getting used to these millions. But you guys had received $233 million of grants from the federal government, but you had actually had over 300 million, because a good chunk of that was a food program. So clarifying this would really definitely be helpful. I think we have a few other questions here. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, the name of the programs kind of seem to overlap. Can you help me delineate what overlap there is in these programs, these three different food assistance programs?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. The programs are I couldn't tell you exactly where they overlap, because I think a student could go into and have a free and reduced lunch, but then also be eligible for the breakfast meal program, or there's also a fresh fruits and vegetable program that they might be eligible for and to receive. So they might be a resident of a child care facility, so they are served there as well. So I could check with the Child Nutrition Services and see if they have the data on kind of the duplication of services, if you will, and see if we have that data.
But just for clarification, could you just explain, the child and adult food program is not necessarily in a school program. If you could just explain the TFAP and the...
Sure, yeah, of course, yeah. The National School Lunch Program is most commonly known, the free and reduced lunch at the school. The temporary emergency food assistance program, many of you may remember a couple years ago when one of the villages flooded, Joe Dawson, who's the director of Child Nutrition Services, coordinated with the U.S. Department to get food out there on an emergency basis because of the flooding. And that's what that program is designed to. It kind of ramps up as needed depending on emergencies across the state. The Child and Adult Food Program is there's a lot of privately owned preschools, for example, that are eligible for free and reduced or subsidized meals. They can apply to the state, and if they meet certain requirements, they can get subsidized meals for their program. Same thing with adult care facilities. So if you have a like a fireweed place here in Juneau that's made for elderly assisted living, they can get through an application get subsidized meals for that facility also for the adult facilities.
And does the Department of Educational Development involved in the senior and the adult food, or is that just something that's tagged onto this? It kind of sounds like mission creep if the Education Department is feeding older people.
It's the federal fund component, so they're all together. So, you know,
that's us.
We implement the school lunch program, but it's all part of the same federal program, so it ends up in our department, but it serves needs outside of, you're exactly right.
That helps me understand. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just checked the Anchorage School District's student nutrition program. 58 schools of the 90 in Anchorage serve student breakfasts. That's a good sign that there are a lot of issues in Anchorage. They wouldn't be serving breakfast if kids weren't getting that at home. I have often thought that a facility like the student nutrition facility in Anchorage, which serves 20,000 students a day, should be running 24/7, 365, processing food, not just for students, but for adults who need it in the community as well. But if you've got students who are hungry, you've got adults who are hungry too. And I did meet with the student nutrition director in Anchorage last year and learned quite a bit about our program. Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. I do want to make one comment here. I do know that families that are on food stamps, which is enough for the whole family, it's enough for breakfast and lunch and dinner, and but those same families qualify for free lunches and free breakfasts, and it's always kind of amazing to me how that works out. So therefore the same families don't have to fix breakfast or lunch because we're doing it at school, and that's just a kind of amazing to me. Anyway, having said that, could you tell us how many school districts serve lunches? Because I know Wrangell School District never served lunches, breakfast or lunches, until just a few years ago. And part of that was because they didn't have a big enough facility, an empty room big enough to be able to put it in because of the federal regulations. You have to have so many sinks and all this type of stuff. And so they couldn't do that. But now they do it. So I'm just wondering how many other schools there are across the state that can't do it, would like to, but they can't. So I was wondering if all the schools do it now, or so just the numbers.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can get that data for you.
Okay, and I'm going to indulge and make a comment at this time, since another comment was made at this table. You know, the mission of education is education. We have 190,000 people on public assistance. We have a department for that. And I know on the Anchorage School District there is a member on that board who has proposed using United Way and things like that. We have more nonprofits per capita than any other And just making sure that we're staying focused on education, I think, is really, really important. And with all these programs, many of them related to nutrition, and I understand the importance of making sure that people are fed, and I understand that. But I think we have pretty well-established programs from what I heard yesterday. I want to know the administrative costs of all these programs, and is it diverting from, you know, making sure that we achieve, you know, the scores that we need to achieve in regards, or do we need to restructure and possibly partner with United Way, Rasmussen Foundation, and others to provide these services so the teachers, you know, can really be getting their lesson plans ready and focusing on, you know, education. So I know it goes hand in hand, but I would like to know the administration costs of these programs.
And we're speaking particularly to the child nutrition programs.
Well, all administration costs, you know, for all these programs, but in particular, you know, right now we need, you know, I know some of the teachers are like, we don't have time to do this because of this, and just making sure that they have the opportunity to focus on their mission.
Thank you,
Representative Wilson, or excuse me, Representative Ledoux.
So, these child nutrition programs, they're all federal grant programs. We don't put any state money into these programs other than the administrative costs. Is that correct, or is that not correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the state has about a $68,000 component into that. The districts provide about another approximately $400,000 a match. The administrative cost is 100% federally funded. I mean, so in other words, the child nutrition team at the department is 100% federally funded.
And just one more question,
please.
These childhood lunch programs, they didn't start out federally initially as a poverty program, did they? They started out like a long, long time ago as part of like the Department of Agriculture to, you know, they were buying food from farmers, and then somehow or other they morphed into this. Is that?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, it still is a USDA program, so it's still run through the Department of Agriculture. The history, we can Google it and find out, but
all right, thank you.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is one more bulleted item that's missing from the last bar. We have donated commodities at the bottom of our chart. Is that the USDA commodities program that provides food to these various student nutrition programs?
Through the chair, correct.
And what is the department's oversight of that, if these are being done at the district level?
Through the chair, I believe that what we do is to do a lot of the coordinating of the transportation of the donated commodities, you know, and I think it's more of a logistically, but to be honest, I can't speak to it specifically. I'd have to get back to you on that.
Please continue.
Right. That's the Department of Teaching and Learning Support. It's by far our biggest component, and I'll do my best to keep you on time, but that's the bulk of our department. The other component, excuse me, that were referenced there on that first organizational chart. We have the executive administration, that's our school board of education, and the office of the commissioner. So my office includes deputy commissioner, information officer, and the work that we do is to work primarily, largely with superintendents, school boards, schools, legislature. So we do that work in our department, or our division. The administrative services, that is the operation of our department. So you'll see the requirements for state and federal reporting, you know, our payroll, our personnel, our own budget, preparation and execution, contract administration. So that all falls within the administration of our department. And the last one is school finance and facilities, and that's Elizabeth Noodleman is the director of that. And that is the funding for our schools. She works extensively with the formula funding, making sure the funding gets to our schools, facilities funding. She heads up the capital improvement projects, the major maintenance list, and makes sure all of that is done appropriately.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I remember at one time one of the governors took all the human resources components and just did it overall. And is that now going back out so that we have human resources people in different departments?
We work with the Department of Administration on the human resources aspect of it, but we do a lot of that in-house. I mean, Mark Lewis, who was just here speaking to that, is the director of the division. Is your question about the management of our personnel?
Yeah.
Okay.
For the record, Les Morris, I'm the deputy commissioner. A lot of the services, through the chair, Representative Wilson, a lot of this personnel services still remain centralized, payroll, those kinds of things. The functions that we carry out is working with them to post positions, or we have to work on our own actions that might be disciplinary employee actions. We do have one staff member who provides support to all of our divisions in doing that, and that one staff member is housed in part of our department. But we still work with a centralized personnel office for many of those functions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Please continue.
Looking at our libraries, archives, and museums, it is pretty straight forward there. We have 69 staff that are in those components. And you can see that we have our historical collections information, our archives, the protection of our state treasures, and our artifacts and our museums. Right now we have looking at trying to wrap up the funding and get the remainder of the funding for our new SLAM project, our statewide libraries, archives, and museums building. If you had the chance to attend the ceremony we had at the beginning of the session, it will be replacing the library that we have here. We already have a hole dug. It's being worked on now right behind the museum. And it'll just about triple the size of our current museum. And because of the efficiencies in the design, we'll be able to operate it at the same cost as what we're currently operating our museum. It'll allow all of our materials and all of our services to be in one building as opposed to three separate buildings. Our archives structure right now is literally crumbling. It's being patched together and to try to protect the materials that are in there. So we're looking forward to completing our SLAM project. One of the more exciting components that just happened in regards to that is in a large project like that, we were thinking that we would have to go overseas to provide some of the components for the construction. And that's one of those components is called a unified curtain wall. It's a structural component on the exterior walls. And we just recently were able to move that component not only to the United States, but we were able to give the contract to Bucher Glass in Fairbanks. So they'll be opening up a large. They're already in place, but they'll be able to open a manufacturing facility. We'll employ 16 people, and this project really has sparked those jobs, those economic development jobs. So we're excited that we're able to do that on such a large project.
Laura. Representative Wilson, thank you. Could you just tell me what SLAM stands for?
Statewide Libraries, Archives, Museums.
Oh, thank you.
So although it's being built here, it really is for our statewide collection. And the last component is Mount Edgecombe. Mount Edgecombe is unique in regards to all other schools in that it is the only state-run school. So they have an advisory board that does their daily operations, policy calls, and things. But technically, their school board is the State Board of Education. The State Board of Education regularly monitors how they're doing and graduation rates, courses that are being offered, as a typical school board would do. It is funded on the BSA component per student, but there is an academic component as well as a housing, a dormitory component. So that's unique to Mount Edgecombe, but similar to the other boarding schools that we have that are run by districts, both in Nenana, Galena, and Bethel.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brief question, Mr. Commissioner. Has there ever been any consideration of putting Mount Edgecombe under the auspices of a local school district? Does it relieve the state of that obligation? Or
High-level conversations. I don't think it's ever been actively pursued. And I think it would take a request for a district that would a district like to run the program and determine what that would look like. I think from a state's perspective, it would be important to look and see if there would be efficiencies in regards to that. And I don't know the answer to that, but
yeah. I'm not advocating, just asking.
Madam Chair.
Representative Roman.
Mr. Commissioner, thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned residential programs at Nenana, Galena, and Bethel.
Mm-hmm.
And those are run through their separate school districts.
Yes.
Not through the state.
Yes. Okay. So those are all residential schools as well.
And when were those established?
I don't have the dates on when those were established.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Seeing none, the committee would like to thank the department and your staff for a good presentation today. We truly appreciate it. And we will meet next Monday, February 4th, at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I'd like to thank you once again. And we will stand adjourned as of 9:53. Thank you. Good job.